Can I add my welcome to Williams? You're all very, very welcome here. Can I just check that everybody can see these two screens okay? Can everyone see one of those two? Fantastic. So looking this evening at Dan Brown's The Da Vinci Code and A Christian Perspective. And you should be able to see the cover of the book there, which has been one of the most popular books of recent years. I have to say that I absolutely loved it. I hope this isn't giving away too much, but it is exactly the kind of book that I love. I read this kind of book. I took another one of his books on holiday, The Holiday William was just so rude about, and I absolutely loved it. Just looking around the room, who else has read the book? And just a kind of discreet English nod of a head or hands up as well. That's very good. And who of those people who likes it? Yeah, good. I'm not the only one. I'm not the only one who reads trash. That's fantastic. No, I love the book. So why do I have a problem with it? It's just a novel. Why do I have such a problem with it? And the problem is what's printed on the first page. Says all descriptions of artwork, architecture, documents, and secret rituals in this novel are accurate. So on the first page, the very first page, is a claim to factual accuracy in the book. And I have to say that is largely true. So the pictures he describes, the buildings, the documents, most of them exist. But the trouble is that he claims more than that, that he has his characters say things that go alongside that claim to accuracy. And there's more as well, because Dan Brown really believes the theory that he's pushing. So here is something that he said in an interview a couple of years ago. Said, I began as a skeptic. As I started researching the Da Vinci Code, I really thought I would disprove a lot of this theory about Mary Magdalene and Holy Blood and all of that. I became a believer. So he really believes the theory he's pushing. It's a novel that's out to persuade as well as just entertain, which it does so well. I don't know if anyone saw the recent Channel 4 TV programme with Tony Robinson, with Baldrick. And they, I thought, were a little bit cruel to Dan Brown, but they basically kept coming back to an interview with him where he said, yes, it's all true. And then Baldrick would head off somewhere else to disprove one more bit of the book and say, it's rubbish. I think that's the word he used the most. And then come back and they'd show Dan Brown again. So, no, I think it's all true. So, please borrow that TV programme. I've got it at home on video if you'd like to borrow it. But lots of the work is done there. I only want to focus on a very few things that a Christian might want to respond to. Because there are lots of issues that Dan Brown raises about Christianity. But lots of those, I simply want to agree with him. I'm grateful he's written the book. I think he's right, even though some of them are really quite critical. So he says, and he's right to say, that the church has often been very bad in what it says about women. That's true. The church has often been very bad in what it said about sex. That's true. The church has certainly been bad in its use of power. I think the moment you put Christians and power, or in fact any human being and power in the same place, you get abuse of power. I personally am very glad that when I tell people I'm a trainee vicar, they think of the Vicar of Dibley, not some kind of huge power figure that they've got to obey. I think he's also right to criticise a view of God that says you need to cause yourself pain or do all sorts of hard things before God will like you. You know, I am not wearing a silly cheat today. There's no belt here. There's none of that going on. None of that is Bible Christianity. Let me read you a verse from one of the Gospels. There should be the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, on your tables for you to take away with you, read more if you'd like to. Let me just read a verse which sums up genuine biblical Christianity. Here it is, probably the best known verse in the whole Bible. For God so loved the world that he gave his only Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish, but have eternal life. So there, just in a nutshell, that it's real Christianity isn't about causing myself pain to make God like me. It's about a God who loves the world and gave us everything, gave us his son. But Dan Brown's book goes a long way beyond helpful, legitimate criticism of Christianity. As I say, I'm with him on that. I'm glad he's written it. Here is the point that I want to engage with him. Here's something that one of the characters says. Almost everything our fathers taught us about Christianity is false. And here's where I want to engage. Because that's a historical claim. I want to engage at the level of history. There's lots we could talk about. Please, if you want to know about the Templars or the Crusades, please ask us. That's about the only bit of history I really know about, and I'm not planning to mention it at all. So do ask that if you'd like to. Please ask about Mary Magdalene, about whether Jesus was married. I just want to focus on two issues in particular. Two issues about the very, very kind of the origins of Christianity, Jesus and the beginnings of Christianity. Here they are on the screen, the two claims, two key claims, I think, that the book makes. The first one is the claim that the Roman Emperor Constantine decided what was going to go in the Bible. That's the first claim. And the belief that Jesus was God only began then. Do you see how if those two things are true, Christianity is a load of rubbish. We might as well just lock the doors tonight, throw away the key and all go home, if those two things are true. So let's look at them one by one. So first of all, Constantine and the Bible. Here he is, here's a picture, natty haircut. He is the first, can everyone see around my head? Good. Not at all like my haircut, thank you. He is the first Christian emperor. First Christian emperor, and he made a big, big difference. That is certainly true. So just some examples. These are, once Constantine is in power, you can have things like this at your dinner parties with Christian symbols all over them. And on your floor, you can have things like this. These are both in the British Museum. You see there, you've got Jesus in the middle who has the same hair. There you go. There's something in it. But Dan Brown claims more than that. The Bible as we know it today was collated by the pagan Roman Emperor Constantine the Great in 325 AD. Constantine didn't just have an effect. He created Christianity. That's what the claim is. I wonder if you read that book and wondered if it's true. So let's test it with the facts. Let's test it with the facts. When was the New Testament written? So here are some dates, a range of when the books were written. Remember, Jesus dies in about 33 AD. So anyone who's good with maths can do the gaps here. So Paul's letters are the earliest, 48 to 68 AD. So we've got a very short gap there. Can I do the maths in my head? A 15-year gap, that's all. The Gospels, the earliest one is Mark, 60-65 AD or so. And the latest one there is John. This range of dates here is the range that scholars generally accept. It's not a kind of special fascist Christian version that I've cooked up here. So 100 AD is the latest. But okay, so that's when they were written. What about the copies we have now? What about the copies? So it's true, documents fall apart. Documents don't survive very well, particularly the material they're written on originally. So I cannot show you a kind of first edition Mark's Gospel. Imagine how much that would be worth. Can't show you the handwriting. So here's a range of the documents we do have. In the British Library, there's a book called the Codex Sinaiticus, which is the whole Bible, Old and New Testament, in the same kind of, you could check it against our English translations today, and you'll see that is from the same date as Constantine. So we've got the whole thing then. But we're not relying on that one only. Let's go backwards. So 250 AD, before Constantine, we've got pretty much the whole New Testament. And definitely the four Gospels are all there, before Constantine gets his grubby fingers on them at all. And we can go back further and further. We begin having smaller and smaller pieces, thousands of them, literally, 5,000 to 6,000 scattered across the ancient world. And some of them are very small, but when we have a small old piece, there's one example there,
from 130 AD, all we've got to do is check it's the same as what we have later on. And we know we've got the Bible that there was originally, not something that Constantine or anyone else tampered with. So we can check from that, but also the Bible is really popular. It begins to be quoted. So if you're a Christian and you're living in the year 96 AD, like a guy called Clement, again, a great name, sorry if your name is Clement, and he begins to quote the Bible, and we have his books, and again, we can check this is the same thing, the same book, it's all the same. It's hugely, hugely quoted from early on. So that's the Bible as we have it, the Gospels as we have them. But what about Dan Brown's claim that there were lots of other Gospels as well? Lots of others. So here are two sources for them that Dan Brown mentions. I'm going to talk very briefly about these. Please ask more questions if you'd like to. He talks about the Dead Sea Scrolls, and he talks about the Nag Hammadi Library. They're two collections, two libraries, basically, of books that have turned up really recently in the last century. They're fantastic. If you're like me, if you're interested in history, this is actually exciting. I don't know if you can join with me in that or not, but we've suddenly found these libraries that we never knew existed before. And Dan Brown's claim is, this is where the secret gospels are that give you the real Christianity that the church has fudged over. And that claim is not true. So the Dead Sea Scrolls have no gospels in them at all. They're a Jewish library. They have lots of great copies of the Old Testament. They're really good for evidence of the world that Jesus lived in. It's a movement that wants a Messiah. There's lots of kind of crossover, but no gospels, no mention of Jesus. The Nag Hammadi Library are written in Egyptian, in Coptic Egyptian, translated from some Greek books written in the 2nd century. That's, again, the kind of majority scholar's view. So, again, look what we're comparing them with. The Gospels written kind of 30, 40, 50 years after Jesus, with these books written all the way into the next century. Definitely, in the 4th century, there's a fight on about, you know, what religion do you prefer? And these Egyptian guys, they prefer a different Jesus. That's certainly true. But they're not equals with the Gospels, as if, you know, Constantine was able to choose. Because here's the Dan Brown picture. You have kind of a bunch of Gospels. I've got Matthew, Mark, Luke and John and Philip and Thomas and Tom, Dick and Harry all on there. I don't know if you can read that. And Dan Brown's view is that there were kind of lots, in fact 80, Dan Brown says, and that Constantine is just kind of picking and choosing and you end up with the ones he liked. Again, let's look at the facts. Here are the facts. Here are the books that we know were agreed and used in churches as if they were the same as the Old Testament scriptures, that kind of authority, all the way across the ancient world, in all four corners of the ancient world, by, and listen for the date, by 200 AD. This is the list that was absolutely agreed on. You could have walked into any Christian church and sat down with these books by 200 AD. Remember, Constantine is 308 to 337. And then there are some other books that they're not sure about. These are the books that we have in our New Testament that don't get used in the same way in every church, in every place. So there'll be some places that think, yes, we've heard of them, we know who they're by, we like them. There'll be the other places that aren't so sure. And yes, there are some other books that they use as well. There's the list of them. You'd be very happy to go and get hold of, look at some of those. Most of them are just simply early books by early Christians. They're not sure, is Barnabas an apostle or not? Should it be in the Bible or not? So just look at the picture that actually is there in the facts. This isn't a free-for-all at all. There's a kind of body of, yes, we agree on all of these, and then there's some fuzzy stuff around the edge. And in the body of agreed stuff are the Gospels, are the books about Jesus. There's no kind of somebody that likes a different book about Jesus. There's no doubt on that. I've tried to get a bit carried away with some pictures. Let's have the next slide. Here is, sorry about the colour scheme. This is Microsoft has chosen the colour scheme. But that is the New Testament, book by book, as we have it now. with the kind of size and length as we have it now. So you can see kind of Matthew's a big book on the left, Mark, Luke is a big book, John, you've got Revelation right at the end. There they all are. Now, what if I take out, this is what I want to recommend to you, if you're convinced by Dan Brown, if you're not convinced by me, if you want to get just the kind of approved version of Christianity, the ones there's no doubt about, let's take out all those ones that were on the list they weren't sure about. Okay, so next slide. Oh, is there already? Thank you. Just we'll skip between them backwards and forwards a bit. Go back. So that's how it is with all of them in. Take them out. And that black box at the end is the kind of number of pages that you would lose. I think that makes the point pretty clearly, doesn't it? By all means, don't read those. There's nothing in them that, you know, I'd say we absolutely need that definitely or the whole of Christianity falls apart. Read the rest. Read the Gospels. Read the epistles of Paul. Get the message from the original books if you're worried by those. I think we're going to need to skip the next slide. Thank you. Let's just get back to the questions. Next slide again. So there are two questions. How are the contents of the Bible decided? Well, not by Constantine. There was a kind of tidying up job being done. And it was being done because the Gnostics were asking questions. But it wasn't a free-for-all. I'll go on to the second question, and we'll go quicker in the second question. Please, again, do be writing questions down if I've confused anyone in there. So, second question. Here's the claim. Until the time of Constantine, Jesus was viewed by his followers as a mortal prophet, a great man, but man nonetheless, not the Son of God. And here is some history. Next slide. Here is some history. The Council of Nicaea in 325. Yes, there was a fight, a kind of theological fight. There was a man called Arius who said Jesus wasn't God. That is true. Dan Brown has that right. But what Dan Brown says is that everybody up till then agrees with Arius. Nobody thinks Jesus is God except Constantine, who sees a nice little learner and decides to push this Jesus is God thing. In fact, there were just under 250 bishops at that council, and they voted on Arius' views. He got to have his say, and they voted. And 99% of them voted against him. It's just simply that the early Christian view across the board is Jesus is God. We think Jesus is God. So let's just see some evidence for that. Here's some non-Christian evidence. Pliny was a Roman governor who was a bit of a kind of fuss budget. He'd write to the emperor the moment he had a question about anything. And he had questions about Christians. And here's how he describes them. They meet on a fixed day before daylight and recite by turns a form of words to Christ as a god. That's a non-Christian Roman governor saying that in 112 AD, very early. Then there's, of course, all the Christian evidence in the Bible and outside it. Here's one particular example. Next slide. This is the first posh Christian. He's called Justin Martyr. He'd have fitted in nicely at a dinner like this. And he writes to the emperor saying, basically, "I'm terribly sorry, old chap. Would you mind not killing us all?" That's his kind of request. Stop persecuting us. And Christians were killed for being atheists. That's what he's engaging with here. And he says, yes, we're atheists in the sense that we don't worship all your Roman gods. But notice who he says he does worship. I've put them in red. He worships the Father, the Son, and the prophetic spirit we worship and adore. That's in 160 AD. Next slide. Here's just a bit of fun. Here's some archaeology. This is very the Da Vinci Code. This is a puzzle. This is called the Rotas Sartor Square. It's an acrostic. And you find these buried, as well as in other places, you find two of these buried in towns called Pompeii and Herculaneum. Now, I don't know if you remember that far back to school, but in 79 AD, Vesuvius blew up and buried these two towns. They're sealed under ash and lava until modern times. There's no way, now I promise I've not dug in there and added some Christian evidence. There's no way. They're covered over. And we find these. And they're a kind of code for persecuted Christians Let's just unlock some of that. Do you see down the middle, in a cross shape, are the words "he holds" in Latin. That's very fun. It also, if you rearrange all the letters, you can make the Latin for "our Father" twice, plus four very significant other letters. But here's the fun bit. Next slide. Everywhere there is a cross, everywhere there is a T, you have an A and an O on either side of it. You have an Alpha and an Omega on either side of it. I don't know if you know the first chapter of the book of Revelation. Jesus' big, big claim: I am the Alpha and the Omega. I am the beginning and the end. A and O, I don't know why Greeks do this, the beginning and the end of the alphabet. I am everything, Jesus is saying. It's a claim to be God. I am before everything. I am after everything. That's the claim Dan Brown doesn't like. But it's there, buried under Vesuvius from 79 AD. We'll skip the next slide and let's just finish up. I hope you've seen some evidence there. It's just a flavour. I hope you want to ask questions. What I'm really hoping is that you will take away one of these New Testament Gospels. There's a range on your table. I hope you'll take one away and read it. I hope particularly maybe if Dan Brown or other things you've read have given you the idea that this is not to be trusted as history. I hope you'll take that away and read it, changed by some of what we've seen. Don't get me wrong, it's pushing a line, this book. It's biased, if you like. They want you to believe that Jesus is God. That's what they think. But they're first century, first-hand historical documents. Read them like you would read a newspaper. I hope you'll take away and read it. I want to just end with two kind of cheeky little slaps. One at Dan Brown, one at us. Here is one at Dan Brown. Mind the gap. So Dan Brown is right. He's brought to everyone's attention the fact that there is a gap in Christianity. It's a 15 to 70 year gap between Jesus and the books that we have about him. And Dan Brown kind of looks at that gap and says, it all falls apart. I want to say not necessarily. Actually, that's the gap we'd expect. This is not a planned conspiracy, Christianity. This is a bunch of guys who believe this is true, walking around the world telling people about it. While they're alive, they do that face to face. As issues arise, they write letters, 15 years. And as they begin to die, they say, wow, we'd better write this down. We get exactly the gap we'd expect from honest men. Now, here's the slap to Dan Brown. How about his gap? If you've seen the Baldrick program, you'll know that his whole case depends on les dossiers secrets that are deposited in the bibliothèque in Paris and establish his whole case about the Priory of Zion. Trouble is that Baldrick has interviewed the man who forged them. And says, no, I did it. Now, he might be lying. You've got to make up your own mind. But anyway, they arrive in 1967. Do you see what I'm saying? Dan Brown's gap is bigger. That's all I'm saying. Here's the final slap. And this is a slap to me and to you, maybe. Everybody loves a conspiracy. That's a quote from Dan Brown. Why is it that I loved this book so much? Why did I love Dan Brown's book? It's partly the characters, partly the storyline, but partly it is a conspiracy between my heart and my head. You see, my heart, and I guess yours as well, depending on how kind of either side of my age you are, your heart will be a 21st century heart. And everything Dan Brown chimes on are all the things I've been brought up to love. He's anti-authority, and he kicks, you know, the big authorities, doesn't he? The Roman Catholic Church and Jesus, God, and his claims to authority over me. And my heart loves to hear that. He's egalitarian, it sounds liberty, it's kind of sexual liberty, it's all the things that my heart says, yes, that ought to be true. And I wonder if there's a conspiracy, even in you, that your heart is kind of over your head somewhat, and saying, come on, this sounds like it should be true, whatever the facts are saying. I think I'm going to leave it there. We'll leave the slide there. We're going to pause. Pudding is going to come round. Please do be writing questions down. The sooner you write them down, people will come and collect them off the tables. The sooner you write them down, the more coherent an answer you will get. So please do write them down, and we'll reconvene after pudding.
Well, I think I have to say we have a sort of record number of questions, and I always say at this stage, you know, well, it's terrific to be able to say it with Charlie here. If you do ever get the chance to come and look at the Christianity Explored course that you'll see on the table there, you've got Charlie for 7 weeks, and you're going to ask him every question you have ever wanted to ask about just about anything. But there were one or two good questions, like, where do you get your hair cut, Charlie? And how old are you really? But we'll skip past those ones. I know the answer to at least one of those questions.
I'll say if you will.
Why is there no mention of Christ in the Dead Sea Scrolls? The slide showed the Dead Sea Scrolls covered the time Jesus was alive. So why no mention of him?
Thank you. We'll go really quickly through these. Please do grab me at the end. The Dead Sea Scrolls are the library of a Jewish group, the Essenes. They're not interested in Jesus, basically. They're looking for a Messiah of a different sort. Jesus doesn't fit the bill. Yes, they're around in the period. They'd have heard of him. He's not what they were looking for. They're not interested.
Thank you. Just kind of stand here, Charlie, because I think people can't see you over there.
Yep.
Just because a book, belief, or statement comes first and is most easily established, does it necessarily make it right and gospel? And if we don't have the original scriptures for the gospels, how can we, or did we, authenticate the dates they were written?
Thank you. So a bunch of questions about, okay, we're saying they're early, but how early, and what do we do if they are that early? The fact that it's early, it might be early rubbish. Mightn't it? It might just be early nonsense. But I think that's as far as I wanted to get this evening. So Dan Brown says it's not even early. I hope I've persuaded you it is early. There's some other books up there if you want to check out some of what I've been saying as well. If it is early, though, then we're open to all those historical questions. Who were they? Why did they write it? Given their eyewitnesses, what persuaded them to believe it? So the thing that persuades me it's right and gospel is the same things that happens when I open my paper and discover that my new MP is accused of various bad things in America. You think, is that story true or not? Who do I believe? Who do I trust? Evaluating the evidence. We're in the same game. It is early. It is eyewitness. It's like the papers.
And when we come to the question later on about what made you trust, will you answer?
Yeah, good.
Okay, so can we move on from those? Yep. Is it possible that Constantine had removed selected pages from the Gospels? And is it possible that there are some hidden meanings in the Gospels that have been lost in translation?
Thank you. Two questions. Yes, it is possible, just, that Constantine removed some pages. But they would have to be pages that don't exist anywhere in any of the 5,000 Greek fragments that we have, or in any of the translations into Italian, into Syriac, into Coptic, that predate him, and all the fragments, manuscripts of those that are scattered across the world way beyond his reach of power. They would have to be pages that are in none of those and contradicted by none of those. So they would have to either be tiny or hugely insignificant, and there's no kind of gap. Oh, I wonder whether, how does the story jump like that? So yes, just about possible, but hugely unlikely, and it doesn't hit any of the main truths of Christianity at all. Is it possible there are some hidden meanings in the Gospels lost in translation? I hope so. That's why I went through 3 years of pain trying to learn the languages that they were written in. I can see people here whose first language isn't English. There are translation things going on as I speak. We don't 100% understand each other. That's not a problem. We do communicate truthfully, effectively. Same with the Gospels. Yes, there are things you get if you know the language better. But no, the essential message isn't disrupted at all. There aren't things that, or maybe it means something completely different if we understood the language better.
Great, thank you very much. What was the criteria for deciding which books were in Who wrote the Gospels? Were they alive with Jesus? How do they relate to the 12 apostles? How do we know that the council that put the books together in the Bible got it right? Could they have included non-eyewitness accounts? Several questions on those.
Thank you. Very, very important questions. So we've said these are early books. We've said that they all agreed on them. Why did they like those ones? And the criterion was, is it by an apostle? There's a question here about what about the 12 disciples? Is it by one of them or by someone closely connected to them? Let me give you an example. On your tables, there are copies of Matthew, Mark, Luke and John there for you to take home and read whichever one takes your fancy. You saw how long they are earlier. So you can, if you can remember that far back, you can choose the short one. To give you an example, Matthew and John, according to the early Christians, were written by the Apostle Matthew and the Apostle John, who knew Jesus himself. Mark's Gospel, we know from an early kind of around the 100 AD Mark historian that Mark was like Peter's secretary. So the Apostle Peter is behind the Gospel of Mark. It's his kind of preaching written up. And Luke is absolutely not an eyewitness. He'll tell you that if you open the first page and read the first four verses. He says basically, I'm a historian. I've interviewed all the eyewitnesses and made you an ordered account. So that's the kind of band of people they'll have. Apostles or their kind of number twos. Or people who've interviewed them. That's the standard of material. So, in fact, Council of Nicaea does no work on what goes in the Gospels at all. Dan Brown's just simply wrong on that. There is a later council afterwards. But all they're doing is, do we think this is by an apostle? So again, imagine the ancient world. Christians are persecuted, and these documents are flying around in secret. So you've got somebody writes to you in Turkey, and we just don't know about it in Spain. We don't know where does this book come from? Who's it by? And so the job that's going on in the 4th century is, no, this really was by an apostle. We've always thought that's who it was. Oh, well, in that case, we'll have it. That's the job they're doing. Is it by an apostle? Is it first-hand witness account?
Thank you, Charlie. Is that book, The Case for Christ, helpful on any of that?
Yes, thank you. There's a table over there with some books and some CDs and things that might be helpful to you. The Case for Christ is kind of history light. I guess.
But history light.
No, it's a great book. It's an annoying book, I think. He's a guy who's gone around and interviewed lots of the top names in this field. So yeah, when I say history light, I don't mean the people he's interviewed. He interviews all the right people, all the right scholars in the field. So it's a great way of getting access to them. He'll tell you things you don't really want to know, like what coffee they drink. That kind of thing. There's one of the people.
I like those bits, Charlie. So, yeah.
But yeah, that would be a great, if you know, the way in through coffee to the great scholars, that would be a great way to read that.
Okay, thank you. Let's move on to some, that's quite helpful, and they'll be on sale. You'll find Vanya at the back there at the table and Holly, who helped Charlie in the Christian Explored, and they'll let you have one of those books. Now, on to some of the issues to do with the book, The Da Vinci Code. Is there a secret Catholic organisation called Opus Dei? Ditto the Priory of Sion.
And very briefly, yes, Opus Dei is absolutely true. And what you make of it depends on which papers you read. My mum's a Roman Catholic. If you read the kind of Guardian-type Roman Catholic papers that she reads, then Opus Dei is sinister and controlling. If you read the more kind of Telegraph-type Catholic papers, then it's a simple organisation for happy Roman Catholics to encourage each other to be better Roman Catholics. It's one of those, and it's not my field, you'd need to go and look at it, but absolutely it's a genuine organisation. I've got friends who are members of it, and you'd need to go and kind of look into it yourself, see what you think. Priory of Sion existed briefly in the 50s as a charitable organisation, then taken on as a kind of surrealist forgery. My copy of the Da Vinci Code on the list of the Priory of Sion Grand Masters is autographed by the living descendant of one of them, who has the same name. That's very exciting. He doesn't think his great-great-great-grandfather was in any secret society. As far as I can tell from Tony Robinson, the TV programme, that is all rubbish, the Priory of Sion. But again, you need to look at that. Make up your own minds.
Thank you very much. What about the links that Dan Brown points out between pagan symbols and Bible symbols? Do you think these similarities are purely coincidental? And is it true that Christianity demonized pagan symbols, circles, sun worship, and that sort of thing, and borrowed existing symbols like the cross?
Yeah, thank you. I'm very glad someone asked this question. It's one of the areas in the book we didn't get time to look into. And yes, there's a lot of truth in some of that. When Christianity arrived, let's take, for example, when it arrived in England, the part of it that I know the story best of, they arrived, people are already having a great kind of knees up at Christmas time for a completely different reason. They're already doing various kind of things at springtime. They're already meeting, probably places like this, very often the exact same geographical place. They're used to going there on the holy day. And the Christians just kind of borrow shamelessly. Now, you could ask me afterwards whether I think that was a good idea or not, whether I think that was helpful. The good thing about it was it got bums on seats very effectively. You know, everyone's used to going there for the big feast. They just keep going. Somebody says they're Christian. Am I? Oh, well, if you say so. And I'm not sure that is what Christianity is. I think there's a very unhelpful side because it leads to confusion. It's a kind of trickery, isn't it, which the Bible tells Christians to go nowhere near. So, yeah, I think that's a fair point in the book.
Great, thank you. Now, a long question here. In Da Vinci's depiction of the Last Supper, a lot of people would argue that it is not the figure to the right of Jesus which has relevance, but in fact the gap between them. The gap is supposedly that of a square compass with a pillar in the background, both being prominent symbols in Freemasonry. Do you think Da Vinci was trying to tell us something about Jesus and Freemasonry or not? And then another book that this person wants you to read, which I'll
Great.
Leave
Thank
you.
Thank you. Yes, the Last Supper picture. I've read, again, art history is not my field at all. I've read various articles on it from different people saying different things. Again, there were some great comedy academics interviewed by Baldrick in his programme, if you saw them. It seems like the question is open. As far as I can tell, it does seem pretty likely that Leonardo da Vinci was a hugely intelligent man who loved messing with church people's heads. And so he's got all sorts of stuff going on in his pictures. It's a kind of running joke on the idiots who are stumping up the money for his pictures. I think that seems fairly plausible. So I'm prepared to believe there's Masonic stuff in there. I'm prepared to believe there's pagan stuff in there. And I don't know. I'm not qualified to judge on that. I'm prepared to believe they're there. But again, it tells us nothing about Jesus of Nazareth. All it tells us is about Leonardo da Vinci over 1,000 years later. It tells you about his beliefs, his opinions. So yeah, it's quite likely they're there. But you need to say Leonardo has a secret access to the real Jesus that we have no evidence of and lots of evidence against before that bites on Christianity at all.
Thank you very much. That's very helpful. Now, look, this great wodge of questions. I don't think we've ever had so many questions on one subject. If Jesus had married a woman and even had children, why would that undermine the assertion that Jesus is God? And if Jesus did have a child, does Christianity fall apart?
Thank you. Obviously, lots and lots of questions about that. That's the main point of the book, isn't it? Anna? The funny thing just is that as far as I can tell, and I've talked to lots of other people about this and seen if anyone can show me where I'm going wrong, as far as I can tell, it makes no difference whatsoever to the essential claims of Christianity. There are some questions in here saying if Jesus was married or had kids, does that make him a man rather than God? Well, not at all. The claim of Christianity is that Jesus was completely man and completely God. So Jesus presumably left behind fingernails and bits of his hair and his beard, if he had one. There's stuff that was Jesus left lying around. Why shouldn't there be children? Presumably he had sperm. That was possible. He may even have been married. That is possible. I don't happen to think that's true. There are some questions about the evidence for that. Most of the evidence for Jesus being married is, come on, most rabbis were, which is true, but ignores the fact that they, even then, the same as kind of now in Roman Catholicism, to be unmarried, to be celibate, was seen as a kind of higher state. So by no means is it necessarily he was. And then there is some evidence in these later Gospels. So in the Gospel of Mary among others. So in these kind of second century and later Gospels, there's a close friendship described. Though again, it stops far, far short of marriage. They kiss. And there's huge scholarly shirt pulling and stuff about whether it's a romantic kiss or a friendly kiss or something else. But yeah, if he was married, maybe. It changes nothing as far as I can see, unless anyone can put me straight. That's never been the claim. Mary Magdalene, I was hoping we'd be able to have this in the church just across the road, where there's a great picture of her in the window with the Holy Grail as well. So again, it's all over everywhere, isn't it? And as far as I can see, it changes nothing.
And just tell us about, I mean, you mentioned there one of these second century accounts. I mean, what kind of historical weight do you place on those?
Thank you. Depending on when they're written, they tell you about the people that wrote them, like any book, don't they? So the earliest, probably, there's a question in that stack, I think, about the Gospel of Thomas. That's the earliest one. And it is a collection of things that Jesus said, lots of which we recognise. So that's useful kind of backup for the Gospels. And then some other things we don't recognise. And that's just really interesting. Maybe Jesus said them. We know the Gospels are selective. They tell us that. Maybe these are the words of Jesus. We can't be sure because they're later. It's not kind of eyewitness. It's secondhand. But that's really interesting. Then the later you get, the more you're just learning about what people wanted Jesus to say. So I'm a Gnostic. I want Christianity to be all about material things bad, spiritual things good, so I write a book with Jesus saying them. All you're learning about is me, not about Jesus. Unless we find some evidence that dates them earlier, that would, of course, change everything. In the meantime, please do read them. On Christianity Explored, very often people ask this question. I'll very often say, I've got some of them on my shelf at home. Do you want to borrow them? And only once so far someone has called my bluff, taken away and read it. But you'd be welcome. I'd love to lend that to you. You could just compare it for yourself.
Thank you very much. Now look on to some questions on Paul, and then just for the last few minutes. What happened to the Christians that were between the time when Jesus was around and they wrote about him? Can we get rid of Paul, please? Christianity would be a lot better without him. You've completely ignored the original split in the church, AD 40 to 70, between Paul, who never met Jesus, and James and the Jerusalem church. Why? Someone who never met him was the architect of the church.
Thank you very much. And that actually leaves out the worst thing about Paul, is that his job before he was a Christian was to kill Christians. So yeah, there's lots we could say about Paul. We do know, it's not that we know nothing about that period in between. Because one of the books that was, you'll have seen on the list, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and Acts. Acts, written by Luke, is his account of what happened in between. And it is a stormy story, some of it. The church grows from a group of 12 people to a movement that the book ends up in Rome, in the centre of the world, challenging the Roman Empire. So it's a major story. And yeah, there are some disagreements. They're all written up there. You can read about them. There's stuff in Paul's letters about a disagreement he had with Peter. The job you've got to do then is compare the basic story. Is Christianity the same? And we'll talk in a second about the resurrection. There were some questions about that. But that is it, really, for Christianity. If Jesus died and stayed dead, then it is all rubbish. Ditch it all. But if Jesus rose from the grave alive again, then he is something special, perhaps even who he claimed to be, God himself. And that claim, that kind of central, this is Christianity, Jesus died, Jesus rose, is there everywhere. It's there, as we saw in the thing buried under Vesuvius, before some of the Gospels had even been written. It's there in everything Paul says, it's there in everything the apostles preach. It's there in the message that gets talked about them. Pliny again mentions, and there's graffiti with kind of Jesus' death, ha ha ha, that kind of thing. So the essential message is the same all the way through. It fits together. The exciting thing about James and Paul is that both of them agree on the resurrection. And just thinking about who they are, that is staggering. Paul was an enemy of Christianity. That was his job. James is Jesus' brother. knows him hugely well, didn't believe in him during his life, was actually a bit embarrassed of Jesus. Both those men come out in the future, side by side, saying, Jesus is alive. My brother is God. Just imagine what it would take for you to say that about your own brother. And my enemy is God. Imagine what it would take. So that on the central thing, they agree. And please, there's loads more we could talk about. Please do come and
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. There's a lot of discussion on that, and pick up Charlie afterwards. If Constantine hadn't done such a big PR coup on Christianity, making it the main religion of the Roman Empire, would it be the world's biggest religion today?
Thank you. It's a great question. It's one of those history what-ifs, isn't it? What if everything had been different? And I simply don't know. Let's have a guess, though. Constantine made a difference. He made it legal, but he also killed the kind of vibrant thing of it. The actual, become a Christian, there's nothing in it for you except Jesus. After Constantine, become a Christian, there's a job in it for you. There's stuff in it for you. It does kind of dilute the thing. Lots of bad things happen as well. I think it would have been as big as it is today. And I'll tell you what, not just because I happen to believe in God and his kind of role in that. I think because the evidence is so strong, because the historical evidence, because the things that Jesus did explode into history and fan out from there, so the evidence would have stood up with or without Constantine. And also because of the offer that's being made here. So I read John 3:16 earlier. The offer is, because of Jesus' death, because of Jesus' resurrection, everything you do wrong, everything that puts you wrong with God, that we all know about, whether we'd admit it or not to ourselves in our hearts, doesn't need some painful belt strapped around your waist, doesn't need some kind of huge dragging yourself up to God. It just needs Jesus. And he'll usher you into God. Come and be God's friend. God so loved the world that he gave his son. That is a message that is dynamite, that speaks to everything human beings need and want, and has the evidence behind it. I think that would have flown anyway, perhaps better without Constantine.
Thank you very much, Charlie. What is it possible to remember much 30 years after the event? How can you read the resurrection as literal? And then, getting rather more personal, that you're a historian, what persuaded you to become a Christian?
Thank you. And the reason I kind of asked for those questions to go together is because I'd answer them all the same way about the resurrection. So 30 years. It is 30 years from Jesus' death before we first get a written account. Actually, it's less. It's 15 years, really. Paul is writing about the resurrection within 15 years. But let's say 30. And yes, that is a long time. I cannot remember the day I was born. That answers an earlier question. And over a similar gap. I guess they can't remember, exactly what clothes they were wearing, that kind of stuff. I guess that is true. But the claim doesn't depend on that. The claim depends on this. Could you remember, 30 years later, the day that the man you thought was God died? Could you remember him dying? Think about any friend you know that you've lost. Could you remember them dying? And could you remember what changed your life 3 days later? What is it that persuaded you to go on this stupid, suicidal, life-destroying thing of trying to tell people about Christianity in the Roman Empire? Can you remember the day when, according to their claim, Jesus walked up to them and said, I was dead, would you like a piece of fish? Jesus is a kind of, these are real events. Jesus barbecued them breakfast afterwards. Jesus walked along the road with them, ate meals with them. It's not like it was a kind of, oh, I wonder what happened then. Yes, you'd remember. Again, obviously it doesn't make it true, but 30 years is no problem for that kind of event. You'd remember. So can we say the resurrection is literal? I think we can. That's what they thought. And Jesus is an event in history. I guess that's where I've been driving all night. You cannot just Dan Brown him away. He happened in history. He lived. He affected people around him. The evidence ripples outwards, more for him than any other man. And as a historian, someone very kindly called me that, so I'll call all of you that. We're all that, aren't we? You could look at this yourself. How do you explain the Jesus event, the church event that is there in history? How do you explain his enemy, his brother, and let's add one more, let's add Peter, his best friend, who knew him best. They all three of them say, I saw him die, I met him again afterwards, he demonstrated to me he was physically, literally alive. How do you explain their conviction? What else happened? That's something we'd love to talk about on Christianity Explored. We give a whole week over to just talking about that. But yeah, that's what persuaded me. That's what keeps me Christian, is the strong, strong historical evidence at the heart that I just cannot explain away. I can't explain the facts there away any other way.
Can I ask you, I mean, I'm going to throw in one of my own, shall I? We've got just a couple of minutes. I mean, what's the so what of the resurrection? Okay, he is alive. You know, so what? Why does that make a difference to you?
Thank you. It makes a difference to everything he said and did, doesn't it? So I could tell you now that I am the Messiah, I am the Son of God. I could make all sorts of things up. I could tell you I'm very good at football or, you know, whatever else, all sorts of things that aren't true. But why would you believe me? Why would you believe Jesus? Well, here is the thing that nails up what he said, doesn't it? He says, I am life. I will give you life if you want it. Life that will last forever. And we can prove that because they'll kill me and then I will come back to life again. And then they kill him. This is better than David Blaine, isn't it? If David Blaine is in a box and you can't see the wires, let's actually kill you, David Blaine. And leave you there dead for 3 days. No pulse, no blood. And then let's see you come back. Which is what Jesus did. That's the history. It changes everything. He says he's God. Well, I guess he is. There was one of his disciples who was Mr. Skeptical, who didn't see Jesus for the first week. Jesus kept him hanging for a week. Said, I won't believe unless I touch him. And so a week later, Jesus rocks up and says, well, go on then, Thomas. Have a prod, put your hand in if you want. And Thomas says, my Lord and my God, which just makes obvious common sense if that's true. And the cash value, like I said, heart and head, the cash value is, if that's who he is, my heart hates it, doesn't it? I don't want Jesus to be God. That means I have to do what he says. And that is inconvenient in so many ways. But that is where the facts drive us.
Thank you. That answers the last couple of questions. I want to just push you one last time on, you know, we've had a lot of evidence and a lot of facts and stuff like that, but what does it actually mean for Charlie Screen that Jesus is alive? Just, you know, from a personal point of view, what difference does it make to you and to Claire as a couple?
Thank you. And I don't know if Claire wants to join as well, but it changes everything now. And it changes everything for the future. So now it means that I say, the Christian claim is, you read the Bible, you know Jesus. He is my best friend. I know him, I relate to him, I talk to him. And I'm not just talking to the ceiling. I'm talking to someone who exists, who is alive. It changes everything now because he said he would give me the kind of life he gets after the resurrection. Life that cannot be snuffed out. That's the cruel thing about life, isn't it? It could just go out tonight. Jesus' life cannot do that. He rose. My life cannot either. I'll die physically, but there is a life like Jesus's after the grave waiting for me. And that just changes everything. Yeah. Thank you.
Charlie, thank you very much. I want to thank you on behalf of everybody and the people who've cooked and served us supper this evening. Thank you very much, everybody, for making it possible. Thank you.